So tonight's March 27th. It's Tuesday evening at Shari Tfilah. We're learning Mishnah, Tractate Bava Kama, Chapter 4, Mishnah 3. So last time, we did the third Mishnah of the fourth chapter, and we started reading the Gemara on it. Today we're going to continue on where we left off. I prepared new sheets, because I have some new sources that I added to the old sheets, so I will give them out. And I have probably made five copies or six copies. So I'm passing three out on this side and two out on this side. So the questions on the Mishnah we did already. Let's read the Mishnah again. So let's see who has the Mishnah. You have some Mishnah there, I guess. So this is the fourth Mishnah of the third chapter. For review, the Mishnah says, "Shur shel Yisrael shenagach shur shel hekdesh, v'shel hekdesh shenagach shur shel hedyot." That's the scenario, which is an ox belonging to Yisrael, belonging to a Jew, that gored an ox belonging to hekdesh, belonging to the temple, comma, and then the other side of the coin, shel hekdesh shenagach l'shur shel hedyot, an ox belonging to the temple, that gored an ox belonging to hedyot, to a normal person, a regular Jew. In the previous phrase, it was just called the Yisrael. In this case, the din is, the law is patur. And patur means that no money changes hands, whether the Yisraeli ox gored the holy ox, or the holy ox gored the Yisraeli ox, there no money changes hand. Patur, in other words, not chayav in any damages. And why is that so? Shanei Mars, it says, Shur Re'ehu, below Shur Shalekdesh. Because the verse says that all this goring stuff is between an ox of a man and ox of Re'ehu, of his co-patriarch, of his neighbor, of his fellow. And that comes to exclude an ox that belongs to Hekdesh. We said last time what that means is we're interpreting the word Re'ehu to mean someone in the same category as you, without defining exactly what we mean. And that means it has to be at least an ox belongs to another human being and not to the corporation. It was me. My phone has indigestion.
Oh my gosh.
It's fun.
Boing. So anyway, because of Shuri Ehu, it's not any old ox, but it's Shuri Ehu, Dakka Shuri Ehu, and ox shel Hekdesh is not Shuri Ehu. It's two different, there's a disparity between the two different oxen, and in that case, it's not called Shuri Ehu, so the verse doesn't cover it. If the verse doesn't cover it, that means there's no verse about it, so it has to be Patur, because the Torah doesn't say that money has to change hands. And then the Mishnah went on to say, Shor shel Yisrael, shenagach l'shor shel goy, patur, an ox of a Jew, of a Yisrael, that gore the ox of a goy, of a non-Jew. Some texts say nochri, the same thing,
or
veid kochavim, it all means the same thing, a non-Jew, patur. So if a Jewish ox gored a non-Jewish ox, patur, doesn't have to pay. Why is that? Doesn't say. And then it says, "V'shel goy shenagach l'shor shel Yisrael," an ox of a goy, of a non-Jew, that gore the ox of a Jew, bein tam bein muad, whether it is a tam, which usually only has to pay chatzin as a half damages, or whether it's a mu'ad that usually has to pay full damages, in this case it doesn't matter, mishalem nezek shalem, has to pay full damage money. So we saw last time that there's a double lack of parity, how do you say parity? Parity here, double lack of fairness. On the one hand, a Jewish ox doesn't have to pay anything, and a non-Jewish ox has to pay more than you'd expect. So it's double lack of parity.
Did it come in the arguments in the Middle Ages?
Oh, yes.
I thought they found
And even before that, we'll see already the Romans
Got
wind of this. Let's continue our review. So last time we asked the obvious question, which is the following. What is the source, what is the reason for this law about the Jewish and non-Jewish ox? And we gave two possible answers to that question schematically. Either the source is the same matter of Re'ehu mentioned in the beginning of the Mishnah concerning the Shor Shel Hekdesh, or it's not. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear.
Right.
If it's the matter of Re'eyu or not. And then we said, wait a second, even if Re'eyu is the reason for the law concerning the non-Jewish ox, and not only the reason for the temple ox, even for the non-Jewish ox, we still don't have a full answer. Because if Re'eyu is the reason, not just for the temple ox, but also for the non-Jewish ox, that only answers half of our question. It would explain to us why a Jewish ox doesn't have to pay when it gores a non-Jewish ox, because a non-Jewish ox is not Re'eyu, so it's Patur, fine. It wouldn't explain why
the
when the...
Way
right, why when the non-Jewish ox gores the Jewish ox, it has to pay double. Double, I mean, more full instead of half. We'd think it has to pay nothing, because it's not in the category of Re'eyu, it's not what the Torah talked about. So even if Re'eyu is relevant not just to the first part of the Mishnah but also to the second, it still doesn't completely answer all our questions. Good evening.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a new sheet for this time that adds to source from last time, but I only have one left, so I'll just pass it down. And the Gemara you guys have, right?
Yeah.
So that's where we left off last time, as far as the Mishnah goes, with that question. And we then began last time to look at the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud the Land of Israel, and the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, and later we're going to look at the Rambam and the Meiri and others in the Middle Ages. In the meanwhile, I decided to add to our sources the two Mechiltot, which are on the sheet, the new sheet,
right,
and I'll explain. Mechilta is really just the Aramaic word for Masechet, which means a book, right? A tractate.
A container.
A container, right. Even though that's technically what the word means, practically speaking, when we use the word Mechilta, we always mean the following. The Tanaitic, Halachic, Midrash on the book of Exodus. Mechilta always means the Tanaitic, Halachic, Midrash on the book of Exodus.
Can we write on this?
Yes, you can. However, it's not so simple because there are two Mechiltot, and the truth is we told the story of the two Mechiltot about 3 weeks ago, that we have a Mechilta that the Jewish people has always known, always learned, the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael, but we've discovered in the past century the other Mechilta, the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, as we talked, so we won't go over that amazingly fantastic and exciting discovery.
It's a real...
So again?
It's genuine.
Yeah. So on the sheet, I brought both from the Mechilta Rabbi Yishmael in B and the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in C on the verses in the book of Exodus that talk about Shor Re'eyu and bring what's relevant to us. Mm-hmm. So we're going to read. Everyone here with us? Mm-hmm. Great.
I don't have the Mechilta.
I didn't.
The new sheet.
I don't have enough.
That's
you
okay.
Have to look
I'll,
up.
That's, I'll yeah. keep. No, okay. It's in the... Yeah, here.
Yeah, so it's in B.
Yeah.
Says the Mechilta Rabbi Yishmael, Re'eyu, quoting that word from the verse, Lotzi Shor Shel Nochri, Shor Shel Kuti, Shor Shel Ger Toshav. Translation, that word Re'eyu comes Lotzi to exclude an ox of a non-Jew, an ox of a Kuti. The best translation
Shalomi.
For that is a Samaritan or a half Jew. I'll explain, and the ox of a ger toshav, a resident alien. So, first of all, the Mechilta answers our question. We asked the word Re'eyu and its halachic implications. Does it only apply to Hekdesh, to the temple, or does it also apply to the non-Jew? And the Mechilta is a clear answer. It applies also to the non-Jew, and that's what's important for us. Of course, that gets us from the frying pan into the fire, because now we have to explain why in the case of the Jewish and non-Jewish ox, why if the non-Jewish ox says it has to pay full, it should have to pay nothing according to this.
Yeah. No.
But we do understand now why when the Jewish ox gores the non-Jewish ox has to pay nothing, because it didn't gore an ox of Re'eyu. So the verse doesn't cover it.
But it brings us to another problem.
What?
Because it removed the Hekdesh issue.
Well, no, it doesn't. I just didn't bring all the Mechilta. The Mechilta also
can
allow that. It can exclude all these things that aren't like you. The temple ox is not like you, and the goy ox is not like you. It's not enough of Re'eyu. So that's the reason we brought this Michilta. Let's just take parenthetically 2 minutes to explain Kuti and Ger Toshav. So like Ilana said, Kuti is the rabbinic word for the descendants of the Samaritans. Who are the Samaritans? Truth is, anything I say is wrong because there's so much controversy who the Samaritans are. Yeah. I'll talk very generally. In Halakha, the Samaritans are the descendants of the intermarriages between two groups. Group number one, the remnants of the 10 lost tribes that remained in Samaria, in Shomron, in northern Israel, after most of their co-religionists were exiled 100 years before the destruction of the first temple. Exiled by
Assyria.
By Assyria. Mm-hmm. And I forgot the name. Sorry, I forgot the name of the general. It's 100 years before the year 586. 100 years before the southern kingdom was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the northern kingdom was destroyed by the Assyrians, and most of the 10 tribes were exiled, but some of the Jews remained.
The one who spoke Yehudit. Yeah,
I don't remember.
No, there's an argument. He's telling him, "Daber Yehudit ki shomim avadecha."
Okay, so they intermarried.
Sancheriv.
Thank you. Yeah. Sancheriv, when he exiled the 10 tribes, he replaced them with peoples he had exiled from other countries, and he brought them to Samaria. He did a population exchange, and the Jews and the exiles who were transferred to the land intermarried with each other, and the generations, the descendants that came out of that intermarriage are called the Kutim. And
so they're not considered Jewish. They're not.
That's the trouble. Right. They are and they aren't. No, not a matter of mamzerim. Are they Jewish? Mm-hmm. Because some of the women were not Jewish and some were. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a rabbinic tradition that these people, the descendants of the intermarriages here, they actually converted to Judaism at a certain point. But there's a question if the conversion was kosher. Why? They're called Girei Arayot. Which means converts of lions.
No.
What does that mean?
By fear.
Because it's fear. By fear. It's told in the book of, I think the second book of Kings, that at one point there were lots of lions attacking them, and they all converted en masse to Judaism because they were afraid that the God of the land is dissatisfied with them.
Yeah.
And the halacha asks, is that a proper kosher conversion or not? And since that time, they've been considered half Jews, in the sense that the halacha isn't clear how to relate to them.
So do we have these people somewhere here now? I mean, are they
in Israel?
Still around. Israel? Did they wear a certain garb? Or
there's some Samaritans in Israel, not too many.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But
how do you know them? Are they by their last names? By
No. They say they're Samaritans. They're the real Jews, actually.
They have a separate right.
They use the ancient Hebrew right.
Everything that I said about their origins, they disagree with.
Oh.
They say they're the real Jews and we're imposters.
Okay.
So anyway, the halakha calls them kutim, and in this particular halakha you see that the kutim are considered like nochrim, like non-Jews.
So that's already in the Mishnah period.
Already in the Mishnah, you have tension between the Samaritans and the Jews.
And what year is this?
We're at the latest 200 years after the beginning of the Common Era, at the latest.
So wait a minute, that is the destruction of the temples or before?
This is much after.
Much after.
Well, again, the codification of the Mishnah.
So 200 AD. 200.
And the codification, what we call the closing years of the Tannaitic period, is 200 after the Common Era. But the material contained in Tannaitic works, in tradition, goes back perhaps much earlier. So it's hard to say. I'll just mention Ger Toshav. Ger Toshav, a resident alien, is a category also half-Jew, in a certain sense. This is a non-Jew who takes upon himself to live in the land of Israel and to abide by the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the seven Noahide commandments. But he converts therefore partially to Judaism, in a certain sense.
Can he own property?
Can he own property?
Why not?
Because I was reading something about on Vincent Fine Notes and something about the
I'm sorry that I don't remember.
I thought the Gerto Shah
agreed to follow the Jewish
law.
There's an opinion in Halakha that there's someone who's taken upon themselves all the Jewish laws except for non-kosher meat, but that is a rejected opinion. The accepted opinion is that it's someone who took upon himself only the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach.
Oh, okay.
As far as I remember.
There's a whole group currently that does that.
Like the Noahide. You call today the Noahides. Yeah. Right? In a certain sense, the Noahides.
Gear Toshev.
It's a machloket, if you can call them Giri and Toshevim. But wait a second, let's stay on subject. We have a lot of interesting stuff to do today. So we learned something very important from the Mechilta Rabbi Yishmael, that Re'eu implies indeed to Nochri, and it comes therefore Lahotzi, to exclude the Nochri. Let's see what the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says about the same matter. So remember the verse that we're talking about in chapter 21, I think it's verse 35 of Exodus, says, if the ox of an ish gores the ox of Re'ehu, of a man gores the ox of his fellow. So says the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, ish prat legavoha.
Rabbi Schlesinger is in luck.
Why am I in luck?
The tall people are excluded.
Oh! You're being facetious.
Yes.
Okay. Does anyone know what gavoa really means?
Tall, no?
No, you're being facetious. You're being serious.
Yeah. Kay.
What does it mean?
What does gavoa mean?
Isn't it high?
And what does it mean in Mishneh Hebrew?
So does that mean somebody that's tall, I guess?
Right, gavoa means big, tall. Big. But it doesn't mean that in Mishneh Hebrew. Mishneh Hebrew means things belonging to the Most High. The really tall one.
The really tall one.
The really tall one.
El Elyon.
Like stuff that belongs to the temple.
Okay. Yeah, it's so pretty much analogous to Hekdesh.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But you see here, in the Mechilta Rabbi Yishmael, they don't learn the exclusion of Hekdesh from the word Re'ehu, they learn it from the word Ish.
And why? How? What's about?
It has to be an ox belonging to an Ish, and the temple's not an Ish. The temple's not a man. It's not a woman.
So we have here that a person versus a corporation.
Could very well be, going back to the discussion last week.
What did the word Parat mean?
Parat means the same thing as Lahutzi, to exclude. And then goes on the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the word Re'ehu prat la'achirin. Achirin is a euphemism for
non-Jews.
And the truth is, it's really the way we talk in English today, the other, right?
Yeah.
Others.
Yeah.
Nishunzo.
So if achirin means indeed nochri, so it turns out the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai agrees with the Mechilta Rabbi Yishmael that the word Re'ehu comes to exclude Nochri or Achirin. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. And then it says Re'ehu also comes to exclude Prat Le Ger Toshav. Okay?
What are his opinions about Kuti?
I don't know. Good question. The question of Kuti really doesn't limit itself to here. The question is, what is a Kuti? Is it a Jew or a non-Jew? Right.
So, can we assume they consider someone a non-Jew?
I don't want to say anything because I don't know. Right. By the way, it's also discussed in the Gemara, in the Bavli, the Kuti vis-a-vis this ox scoring stuff. I didn't bring the material for us.
Is this whole thing to say that certain privileges are not allowed to non-Jews?
Well, we don't know if the word privilege is in place here.
Yeah.
We're talking about the goring stuff.
We are treating family differently than we treat strangers.
Yeah.
What is the shock?
that's kind of what this is about.
I don't want to answer the question because that's prejudicing. Is the word privilege right here? Is the reason what Ilana said, or the different reasons? Or there's just so much to learn here.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not fair to me to say anything.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is it? If we go further, will I see more?
Of course.
Thank you.
Of course.
What is Toshav?
So far, it's just
Toshav. Gear Toshav. Literally a.
Resident.
A sojourning resident. Ger Toshav is literally a sojourning resident. We call it Kuma a
immigrant?
But the word that I just used earlier,
Abraham,
did I use a phrase? A resident alien. That's the way the English translations call him, a resident alien.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not just passing through. He's intending to live there.
Yeah,
right.
He is intending to live there.
Right. So, for our purposes, we've learned that both the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael and the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai both agree that the word Re'eyu comes to exclude Goy, Nochri. Okay? And therefore, if we can assume that that is the proper way to read the Mishnah, and that's a legitimate assumption, it's not proof, it's legitimate, that would mean we understand why in our Mishnah, if a Jewish ox gores a non-Jewish ox, doesn't have to pay. Because it's not real. But it doesn't explain to us why if the non-Jewish ox gores the Jewish ox, he has to pay double what he might have to pay otherwise.
Why?
Full nezik as opposed to chatzi nezik.
I mean, they're being penalized for not being Jewish.
But we have to stick to the technicalities of the text.
Okay.
If the word re'eyu comes to exclude non-Jew, then what it means is that we don't have a text that tells us what to do when Jewish and non-Jewish oxes intergore.
So every time we don't have a text,
so there's no text.
Penalize?
The assumption is that there's no text that tells us to take money from X and give it to Y. No such text, then we don't take money. We just leave it. Nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
So we understand why if the Jewish ox scores the non-Jewish ox, doesn't have to pay. There's no text that says he does.
Okay.
But in the opposite case, when the non-Jewish ox gores the Jewish ox, we'd expect you don't have to pay. There's no text. Why does it say you have to pay full damage? Don't know. At this point, question mark.
Oh.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that brings us now to the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud Land of Israel, which is source D. And we did this last week. Let's just review it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
D again in the sheet. Shor shel Yisrael shenagach l'shor shel Nochri v'chule. In other words, the ox of Yisrael that gore the ox of a Nochri, etc. It's really as if we have the whole Mishnah as our opening phrase there. Let's not read what the Yerushalmi says that the Bavli is going to repeat, because we'll go into greater detail later about that. Let's just read the parts that are not going to be found in the Bavli. So that means we'll start in the last two words of the second line. Rabbi Abahu.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Rabbi Abahu, b'shem Rabbi Yochanan Amar, kidinehen. Rabbi Abahu, in the 4th century in Caesarea, said the name of Rabbi Yochanan, who's in the 2nd century in Tiberias, kidinehen, like their laws.
So that's here.
Did we behave according to their laws?
Yes.
Now we don't know what case he's talking about. Is it the case where the Jewish ox scores the non-Jewish ox, or the opposite, or both? It could be both. It could be we're saying that if we went to their courts and a Jewish ox scored a non-Jewish ox in their court, they'd make us pay full.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll make them pay full in the corresponding case. Whereas if their ox scored our ox in their courts, they would not make it pay anything, so we won't pay anything. It could be, it's just reciprocity on both levels. Could be.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps it's only on one level. We don't know.
So is it like Dina de Malchuta Dina?
No, it's almost the opposite, right?
Yeah.
Because we're doing the opposite of what they would do. We're doing reciprocity.
It's kind of like diplomatic immunity.
Yeah, right. Someone used that phrase last time. Like
diplomatic immunity.
Yeah.
Somebody's, you know, a foreign diplomat, you know, run, it's your car. You know, they don't necessarily have to pay you. Or like not paying parking tickets is another.
The non-Jewish law doesn't apply to Jews. Our Jewish law doesn't usually apply to non-Jews. It could be the same thing. So, according to their court system, if a Jew a Jew's ox scores a non-Jew's ox, they don't have to pay because you know we can't make it. Diplomatic immunity, we can't make you pay, you know, you're not part of our country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if we gore someone else, we will pay just because, you know, if one of us
mm-hmm.
gores, if one of our oxes gores one of yours, we will pay because that's what we would do anyways.
But we won't pay.
No.
Not in the Jewish court.
If a Jewish ox scores a non-Jewish ox, the halakha is don't pay.
Yeah.
According to Jewish law.
Yeah. I'm talking about according to non-Jewish law.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's leave the Yerushalmi at that.
Okay.
Let's
okay.
leave the Yerushalmi at that, and let's go on to the Bavli. So the Bavli I gave out last time.
Yeah.
Right? And today I only gave out two copies. I only had two copies. Mm-hmm. So everyone has. Great. So we'll start reading again the Bavli that we learned last time, and I think I have a better handle on it than I had last time, a little bit better.
It looks like a Steinsaltz edition.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. I photocopied from the edition of Rav Steinsaltz. Right. This is the Gemara. It's Daf Lamed Chet Amud Aleph 38a in Rav Steinsaltz pagination. It's page 160, the second line at the top of the page. Shur Shel Yisrael Shenagach L'Shur Shel Goy. That's a quote from the Mishnah. Patur. And says the Gemara, Amri, they said, Mimanafshach, you have to have a whole sentence to explain what it means. It means, however you cut it, it doesn't make any sense. Pull it from this end, doesn't make sense, pull it from that end, as we already explained, right? It's just unfair, and explains why it is not making any sense, because, I re'ehu dafka, if you take the word re'ehu as if it's dafka, it's specific, it applies to the matter of Jews and non-Jews, then, de goy kinagach de Yisrael nami lipatar. Then an ox of a goy that gores the ox of Yisrael should also be exempt, as we've talked about for the past 20 minutes. Vi re'ehu lav dafka, but if the word re'ehu doesn't apply specifically to non-Jews and only applies to hekdesh, to the temple, then afilu de Yisrael kinagach de goy nechayev. Then even when a Jew gores a non-Jew, it should have to pay. If the word re'ehu is not involved here. So, you know, tell me which it is. It doesn't make any sense. So with that question echoing, the Gemara brings a midrash, and goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I just realized, and no one stopped me, that after I worked so hard to bring the rest of the Mechilta, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, we just skipped it. And you didn't even catch me on it. So,
well, sometimes you skip things in
right,
the spring,
right.
So
we really want to learn the rest of the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and I forgot. So we're going back to there.
Okay.
We only learned one line of the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. The second line says, Yechol lo yishalem al yedei hagoy. Velo yehei hagoy mishalem al yado. Translation: Yechol means it could be. You could have thought that will not pay by the hand of a goy, and not a goy will pay by his hand. What that means is, you could have thought that after we said that re'ehu comes to exclude the goy, you could have thought that works in both directions.
Right.
Whether out of this hand or that hand. That's what you would have thought, right? That's logical. Mm-hmm. That's what you would have thought. Yechol. Talmud Lomar. Right, I'm in the middle of the line now, after the hyphen. Talmud Lomar, which means the verse says, Shalem Yishalem. Lerabot Shel Goyim. In other words, even though Re'ehu comes to exclude Goyim, and you'd think it excludes in both directions, the ox of a non-Jew that gores a Jew, the ox of a Jew that gores a non-Jew, that's what you could have thought, that it's equal. But Talmud Lomar, the verse says, Shalem Yishalem. What does the verse say? At the end it says, if the goring happens, pay will certainly pay. Shalem Yishalem. Why the extra appearance of the word Shalem? Why is one not enough? So the Mechilta says it comes to bring back into the picture the goy, but only back into half the picture.
Only when he should pay.
Yeah,
right,
it's
right.
You know,
because of Re'ehu, you would think that whenever a non-Jewish ox is involved in any direction, doesn't have to pay. That's true, but then you come to the Shalem Yishalem that comes to teach us a payment that you wouldn't think has to be paid. Which payment does it come to teach us that you would have thought doesn't have to be paid? That's when the non-Jewish ox gores the Jewish ox. Or the non-Jewish ox, or when they ger toshav, the ox of a resident alien gores a Jewish ox. So the Mechilta, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, was aware of the lack of parity, mm-hmm. and it found a biblical source for it.
The double emphasis.
Double emphasis. Shalem Yishalem. Mm-hmm.
And what does that word shalem actually
pay,
mean?
Pay.
It's pay.
Mm-hmm. It means pay, oh.
pay.
Pay will pay.
Okay.
So that actually is pretty interesting for us, because we've been suffering with this lack of symmetry, and now at least we have some type of law source for it. Mm-hmm. We might not like the source, we might not like the law, but at least we have, right, some basis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's pretty interesting.
What about the rest of it?
The rest of it, thank you.
Yeah.
So is it written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai?
Not necessarily.
Just a
but
tribute.
It reflects perhaps his Beit Midrash. By the way, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was a Talmid of Rabbi Akiva.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Rabbi Akiva mm-hmm. is the one who holds that every word in the Torah has meaning. And Rabbi Akiva says explicitly,
even
when you have
tag.
A double verb, mot, yumat, shalem, yishalem, it has meaning. Rabbi Yishmael disagrees.
Right.
And he says, Dibrat Torah Lashon B'nei Adam, the Torah speaks the language of men. And Mot Yumat doesn't necessarily mean a double death, and Shalem Yishalem doesn't necessarily mean an extra payment. But this is the approach Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who's a student of Rabbi Akiva.
Didn't he also explain Tagim and
Rabbi Akiva would Doresh Tilim Shel Halachot from every Tag, right?
Yes.
Learn out lots of halachot from even the little crowns on the mm-hmm. on the letters. Rabbi Akiva was a maximalist as far as the creativity and the mandate to find meaning in every word and every letter and every sign. Yechol Yehu Mishalmim Betam Chatzi Nezik Muad Nezik Shalem. In other words, after we already said that because of Shalem Yishalem, the goy has to pay when it gores a Jewish ox, but how much does it have to pay? So it says, Yehu, you could have thought, Yehu, that they'll be paying betam chatzinezik, in a tame ox chatzinezik, half ox, half nezik, and the muad nezik shalem, and in a goring ox, full damage like we expect in Jewish oxens, but no. Talmud Lomar, the verse comes to teach you, Shuri Ehu.
So we're back to Re'ehu.
Meaning, Shuri Ehu, Yotzei Keseder Hazeh, Velo Shel Acherin, Yotzei Keseder Hazeh. Which literally means, the ox of a co-patriarch comes forth like this order that a Tam pays half and a Muad pays full, Velo Shel Acherin, but not of others. Comes forth according to this order. So we're back there. In other words, a little bit Re'ehu applies and a little bit Shalem Yishalem applies. And we have to work out the balance between the two of them.
Yeah.
I would not call it balance.
You know, a lot of this sounds like this text made it into the Mishnah. And clearly existed before the Mishnah was codified. These rulings existed. And now they've got to go not only figure out why, but almost apologetics for it. Because they're trying to justify why should the non-Jew pay Nezek Shalem when the Jew doesn't even have to pay anything.
It's because he's your brother.
It's your brother. And of course, what to me gets really interesting is now is once they are no longer the law of the land,
mm-hmm.
and they're living under somebody else's authority, they don't have the authority to make that non-Jew pay.
They don't have that many bulls either.
No, that's right.
They don't have the odds.
So I'll just kind of give background to what Jan said. We've mentioned in the past that it's an open question in many cases what came first, the chicken or the egg.
Right.
Yeah. In the sense of, is it that the Midrash Halacha is the source of the law? Possible. Or is it that the Midrash Halacha comes after the law has already become the law and it's an effort after the fact to connect it to the verses. And by the way, neither of those two approaches is more or less traditional, or more than less orthodox, or more than less out there. Both of them are in the sources going back a long time, being discussed.
Right.
Many will tell you that the law is Torah Sheba'al Peh. Right? It's the law. Wherever it comes from, it doesn't matter. It comes from God, it comes from the synagogue, it doesn't matter. But the rabbis wanted to connect it to the verses by way of Midrash Halakha in order to help us remember it, in order to give it greater authority in the eyes of the people. Or the others say no, that the Hachamim were given rules of how to darshan the Torah to create law. Now, although we have this polar argument among the commentators, it's very possible that they're both right, and some midrashim are of this type, and some midrashim are of this type. The Hebrew phrases that we use to describe these different types of midrashim, a midrash that would be considered to be the source of the law is a midrash yotzer, a creative midrash. A midrash that's considered to be a pin the tail on the donkey, and it comes after the law, that's called an asmachta. Mm-hmm. Comes to lean on the verse. And again, both of these approaches are found in the traditional commentators. None is more traditional and none is more innovative than the other, more modern than the other. They're both ancient possibilities. Now, what's fascinating, especially for those who've already seen the Babli last time, is the last 10 words or 12 words of the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And this is on the last line of the Mechilta, in the sixth word, after the comma. Va'alehen hu omer hofia mihar paran. Hofia panim keneged kol ba'ei olam. Translation, and concerning them, it says, hofia mihar paran, he appeared from Mount Paran. And that verse, of course, we learned last time, is from Parshat Zot HaBracha?
Yes.
No, Hazino. Right. Last time I got it wrong. From Hazino. And it's
no, you said Hazino last time too.
Yeah, it's right at the beginning of
And the verse in context is saying something unclear, but according to the Midrash that many of us have heard of, it's about the Kadosh Baruch Hu giving the Torah and first going to Har Paran, offering it to the Goyim, and having them refuse it.
Mm-hmm.
And in that context, perhaps we should understand this usage of the word. And it's telling us that when God went to give the Torah, he first offered it to all the other nations, and he went to the nations that were at Har Paran. They refused it. And what did God do to punish them for refusing it? Hofia panim keneged kol ba'olam. God showed his face against all the nations of the world. And the implication seems to be that because they refused to accept the Torah, he penalized them by writing in our Torah that we get their money. In the cases we talked about, right, just now. That if their ox scores ours, they have to pay full. And if our ox scores theirs, they're penalized that we don't have to pay them anything.
What does Hofia mean?
Hofia means to appear. So, again, I'm assuming that we should connect this Midrash to the Midrash of God offering the Torah and getting a negative response, which means that the Midrash is saying that the laws we've been learning about are kind of a punishment, a fine, for the fact that the nations didn't accept the Torah. Now, what's important for us is that the Mechilta brings this explanation only after bringing the halachic explanations. In other words, it's icing on the cake. But it's not the halachic explanation. It's a nice midrashic explanation, midrash agada. First comes the halachic technical stuff of re'eyu and shalem yishalem. Okay.
And what was Paran mean?
Paran is a place. It's a
just the name of a place?
Yeah, yeah, it's either in the Sinai desert or it's in Saudi Arabia right across the waterway that's called the Gulf of Eilat.
Mm-hmm.
When the Talmud brings that, he brings it from a brighter.
So let's get to the Talmud. So let's now go back to the Bavli we started 10 minutes ago, and I remember that I wanted to continue with the Michilta. So here we are back in the Bavli, and it's from the top of the page, line 6, where it says, Amar Rabbi Abahu, trying to answer the question of Re'eu. Right? Is it Re'eu? Is it not Re'eu? Amar Rabbi Abahu, Amar Kra, Amad Vaimodid Eretz Ra'av Yeter Goyim. Verse from Habakkuk, which in context it means that God stood and he shook the earth and he swore and he made the Goyim tremble. That's what it seems to mean in context. But the Midrash brought by Rabbi Abahu understands differently. Ra'ah sheva mitzvot shekiblu aleihem b'nei Noach kivan shelo kimu amad vitir mamonan liYisrael. Translation, Ra'ah, he saw. Now that word comes from the verse that God saw. So what did God see? He saw the sheva mitzvot that the B'nai Noach had accepted upon themselves. Since they didn't keep them, Amad, God stood, right? That's the beginning of the verse where it says Amad, God stood. He stood v'hitir, and he loosened their money to the Jews. In other words, he took the money out of their hand and gave it to the Jews, and it's using the word hitir as a translation, a midrashic understanding of the word v'yater, in context means to tremble, but it's understood to be the same root as to release. So according to this midrash, what we learned in our Mishnah is not a matter of penalizing the non-Jews for not accepting the Torah. It's rather penalizing them for accepting the seven mitzvot and not keeping them. And I also add, of course, this is important, that Rabbi Abahu runs to the Midrash Agadah, and he doesn't bring halachic midrash like we saw in the Mechilta. It doesn't bring Re'eu, doesn't bring Shalem Yishalem. He just goes immediately to the Agadic midrash, which to me is problematic. You know, to use this Agadah from Habakkuk, which isn't from the Torah, to explain halacha is not so acceptable, not so normal. It's usually that you use midrashic, halachic exegesis of Torah, like we found in the Mechilta. First it used midrashic exegesis of Torah, I should say, halachic exegesis of Torah, and then it went to verses that were more agadic.
Well, he was doing that because this seems to him to be more to the point. You know, it's about Jews versus the nations.
But what about Re'eu? Bring me something from Re'eu.
Re'eu's another thing about a man in a field and an ox and some, his neighbor. It's not about why God would punish the non-Jew.
You're looking at this from what can I show it? A Western point of view, a modern point of view. You're looking at his ideas.
Mm-hmm. Why can't you say that just applies to the Beit HaMikdash, and this is a whole different ballgame?
Oh no, you can, and that's what he's saying. But we rarely see learning halacha from a verse that's not in the Torah. That's in the Book of Habakkuk.
So perhaps he thinks that it doesn't apply.
What doesn't apply?
That Re'eu isn't like
fine. But how could you learn halacha in the Book of Habakkuk? Well, the principle is usually you learn halacha only from the Torah, that the Nevi'im don't have the authority to teach us how to behave as far as halachic matters. It's a pretty well-known rule. This is out of the ordinary. Let me just give you an example. There are some Hilchot Shabbat we learn from the Book of Isaiah. What are the verses in Isaiah? Help me out.
Comfort?
It says, honor the Shabbat, don't do your business on Shabbat in the Book of Isaiah. And the rabbis make a point of emphasizing those laws learned out from Isaiah are the Rabbanan. Because it's only Isaiah. It's not Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. And this happens again and again and again. We just don't learn halacha from the prophets.
But so regularly rabbis quote from the Psalms for support.
But not for halacha.
But not for halacha.
To teach a nice idea.
Okay.
To strengthen something.
Could he be trying to point out, could he be trying to point out that, hey, this is not from the Torah, this is the Rabbanan?
Yeah. In other words, that's a good point. In other words, right, so that's the question. Benny's question is exactly what we have to talk about. How did the Gemara begin? It said, is Re'eyu relevant here or not relevant? And then it said, we don't know, there's a contradiction, Amar Rabbi Abau. Okay, so how does Rabbi Abau answer that question? Is it Re'eyu or not? Now, okay, Rabbi Abau brought what he brought. So now, how does it answer the question? The question was, is it Re'eyu or is it not? Is that playing in the game or not? So what does he say? It's not clear.
No.
So what we could say is that if Re'eyu is not playing in the game, Re'eyu only applies to Hekdesh but not to Goy, so that would mean according to the Torah, right, the five books of Moses, that you have to pay ox of Jew, gore is non-Jew, ox of non-Jew, gore is Jew, you have to pay. And then Rabbi Abba's Pasuk verse is coming to say, but they're penalized. Non-Jews are penalized, and when we gore them, they don't have to pay. Mm-hmm. I don't like that. I don't like that reading, because it has the book of Habakkuk overriding a verse in the Torah.
Right.
Therefore, we have to say the opposite. Mm-hmm. The opposite would be Rabbi Abba is saying Re'eyu does apply. And according to Re'eyu, it means that a Jewish ox that gores a non-Jewish ox doesn't have to pay. And a non-Jew that gores a Jew doesn't have to pay. But why do we say anyway that the non-Jew has to pay?
Because
that's
Habakkuk.
That's a rabbinic, like Benny said, that's a rabbinic ordinance. That according to the Torah doesn't talk about it, because Re'eyu excludes. The Torah doesn't say that for what you have to do. And therefore we have now, in the case of a lacona, that's the good way to say it. Re'eyu creates a lacona, creates an empty space. Re'eyu creates a lacona. The Torah didn't talk about Jewish oxen and non-Jewish oxen getting into an intergoring festival. So then Habakkuk has room to speak if the Torah didn't talk about it. That's what I would say. That's just my opinion at this point, right?
So that lowers that relationship, that thing into a takana instead of the oraita.
Yeah. At oraita, we don't know anything.
Right.
Because Re'eyu excludes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we have a Midrash Agadah that says that's the foundation for the rabbis penalizing the goyim.
And the rabbis had the authority to levy a fine.
Yeah. Right.
So they had the right to do that.
Right. Right.
Have we come to a conclusion as to why that was that way?
Not at this point.
Yeah,
we still don't have it. Okay. It's coming up.
So if we're right, of course, in what we're saying, that means the Bavli holds different than the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. The Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai wanted to found this whole thing in halachic exegesis, Re'eyu and Shalem Yishalem. The Talmud doesn't know anything about Shalem Yishalem, so it has Re'eyu, and then it has the Pasuk from Habakkuk.
So that means that the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was lost already at the time of the Talmud.
It's a good question. It couldn't have been lost already, but it could be that that's
they
material
didn't
they didn't know.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, someone knew it. It wasn't lost to the Middle Ages. But not every sugya in the Gemara knows all the brightot, all the halachic material. They could have either known it and disagreed or not known it.
That's true, too.
Rabbi Yochanan Amar. If we brought Rabbi Abau's approach to this whole thing, mm-hmm. and now Rabbi Yochanan's approach.
Mm-hmm.
Mehacha, from here. From here is going to be the answer to the question of understanding our Mishnah. Mehacha, from here. New line. Ophiya mihar paran. He brings that same phrase that we saw in the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and he says, "Mi paran hofia mamonam li Yisrael." From paran appeared their money to Yisrael, and he's leaving out words. He's assuming God appeared and took their money and gave it to Yisrael. The same thing as we found.
That little part is Mishnah or Talmud?
It's not Mishnah. It's Rabbi Yochanan speaking.
Rabbi, that's Rabbi Yochanan ben Lakish?
No.
Oh.
This is Rabbi Yochanan, the first generation of Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael.
Oh, that's what confused me. Okay.
Yeah. So, therefore, we have now two different versions of the foundation, according to my reading, of why we penalize the non-Jew. And just let me point out now that Rashi says something that you guys can't read because it's cut off from the photostat.
Right.
But the upper corner, upper left-hand corner, yeah, and then you have the word miparan, and the rest is cut off, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What Rashi says there,
something kol ha'umot v'lo kiblua.
Right. Shesivei v'chzir ha'torah al kol ha'umot v'lo kiblua. When God went around and brought the Torah to all the nations, and they didn't accept it. In other words, Rashi says, Rashi is my source when I said this 10 minutes ago, that the use of the verse Hofia mihar paran is based on the midrash we know about God going and offering the Torah and not being accepted. So what that means now is the following. We have a nice machloket between Rabbi Abahu and Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says the goyim are being penalized for not accepting the Torah. Rabbi Abahu says they're being penalized for accepting the Sheva Mitzvot and not doing them. That's an interesting ideological machloket, right? And it might even be deeply relevant in the following sense, that Rabbi Yochanan holds that the Torah is for all human beings. And the non-Jews are being penalized for not accepting it. Rabbi Yochanan says, what are you talking about? Torah is only for Jews. You can't penalize them for not accepting it. They're penalized for not keeping the Shev Mitzvot B'nei Noach. In other words, Rabbi Abba, you can see, is a particularist. There's 7 mitzvot for Goyim, and there's Torah for Jews. Rabbi Yochanan says, no, the Torah is for everyone. And this machlok, it actually plays itself out in lots of different areas in halacha, including the matter of conversion. How do you encourage conversion? Do you discourage conversion? That could be a machloket between Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Yochanan.
Yes.
Is that fascinating?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can Rabbi Yochanan say that? How can he disregard the Shev Mitzvot?
Not disregard them, but l'hatchila, to begin with, the Torah is for all human beings, and we should encourage all human beings to adopt it. If they don't, then at least Shev Mitzvot, right?
Okay.
But the approach that we find in some commentators, like the Rambam, that ideally Torah is for all human beings, that could go right back here to Rabbi Yochanan. Whereas the more traditional approach, not the Rambam, but the other commentators would say the Torah is only for Yisrael, right? That could go back to Rabbi Abba.
The Rambam says that the Torah is for all human beings?
Yep.
Wow.
And Hilchot Melachim.
With regard to this, offering the Torah to all these other countries, are we supposed to feel good about the fact that we were last on the list?
That's right.
And I particularly like the midrash that says, "You know, the mountain over our head."
Right. Bottom of the barrel.
Right. Is there?
That's the question of how literally you take that midrash. Mm-hmm. If you're taking it literally, it doesn't look good for the Jews, does it?
No.
No, I mean, I always thought of it positively, and it just occurred to me now. Maybe it's
maybe
it's not so good. But in
we were God's last chance.
Literature, it's ever considered as a.
So the way the Maharal, you know what? Let me not quote the Maharal. I might be misremembering, but the way some say it is the midrash wants to say that God knew that they wouldn't accept and we would accept it. He just went through the motions in order to punish them.
That's a nice way of
saying it. That's a nice way.
Okay.
Nice way of saying we weren't his last hope.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So let's now read on. Tanya Nami Haki. In Abraita we learn thus. Shor shel Yisrael shenagach shor shel goy patur. Shor shel goy shenagach shor shel Yisrael bein tam bein muad mishalem nizek shalem. That's a direct quote from our Mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
But the Braita goes on. Shneamar, as it says, Amad bimoded eretz ra'av yater goyim. As it says, That's same verse from Habakkuk. Vomer, and it also says Hofiyami HaParan, end of the Braita. In other words, what Rabbi Abahu said, without quoting an earlier source, and what Rabbi Yochanan said without quoting an earlier source, are combined in one Braita that precedes Rabbi Abahu and Rabbi Yochanan by potentially hundreds of years, which only brings out the point that I mentioned to Ilana just 5 minutes ago, that it's very possible that Amoraim don't know Braitot. So here the editor is saying that Rabbi Abahu had this tradition and he told it to us, but he didn't know how old it was. Rabbi Yochanan told us an alternative tradition. He didn't know really where it came from. The editor says, but notice that really the truth is that both of these traditions are found in one Braita and preceded both Rabbi Abahu and Rabbi Yochanan. They didn't know about it.
I'm sorry, what's the Amoraim again?
Amoraim are the rabbis of the Talmudic period.
Okay.
As opposed to the Tanaim, the rabbis of the Mishnah period. So that again is fascinating, but it's, can't know everything. You don't have a computer with all your databases on it. You know a lot, more than we could ever know, but you can't know everything. Now, when we saw Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Abahu separately, we pointed out there seems to be an ideological machloket. Is the punishment of the goyim for not doing Shev Mitzvot, or is it for not keeping the Torah, not accepting the Torah? But in the Braita, both the two psukim that served Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Abahu respectively are brought in one Braita.
What's a Braita?
Braita is a source from before the year 200. A source of the Mishnaic period that's not found in the Mishnah. So we're going to ask ourselves, why does the Braita bring both verses? And that's exactly what the Gemara now says. Why does it bring both verses? So the Gemara says, my Vomer, what does it say? And it says, one verse is enough. Why two? And the answer is as follows. V'chitema hai v'amad v'imodid eretz mi'bayle l'chederav matana v'chederav Yosef. The answer why the Braita brings both verses is v'chitema, is because you would have said, what would you have said? You would have said, Hai v'amad v'imodet eretz. Hai means that. That verse from Habakkuk that says, Amad v'imodet eretz, mi'bayle, is necessary for him for that of Rav Kahana or that of Rav Yosef. In other words,
Matana.
Because that verse of Habakkuk is used in two alternative drashot, and you might have said, well, if I hold by one of those two other rabbis that use the verse for X or Y, then I can't use it for the purpose that we're using it now. Therefore, we had to bring an alternative verse.
You cannot use the same verse for a few things?
That's a good question. You can certainly use it for two different agadot, but could you use it for two different halachot? Because here we're really on the border of halachan agadah. Right? That's what I said earlier. The Mechilta, Rabbi Shimon Yochai, is good. It uses halachic methodology. But here we're using agadic methodology to prove halachic points, so I'm a bit uncomfortable with the whole thing. And this matter of saying that you can't use one verse for two things is a halachic methodology. It's not an agadic methodology.
What does agadic mean?
Agadic means non-halachic.
Tradition?
No, it means non-legal, but rather... everything but legal.
Literary.
Explanatory, but not legal.
Okay.
So...
we're in a mess. Yeah.
So therefore, it now we're going to read a line that I didn't know how to explain last time.
Okay.
Tashma.
Tashma.
Tashma hufiya mihar paran, miparan hufiya mamonam liyisrael. It's just saying that because the verse from Habakkuk potentially is already tied up, that's why the Braita brought the second verse. Tashma, is because the first verse is already tied up, potentially, therefore, come in here, Hofim Yaparan, the second verse, Miparan, Hofim Amun Sinners, it just brings that end of the Midrash to say that the end of the Midrash is brought because the first first verse might be potentially already tied up and unavailable. Therefore, tashma, therefore come and hear the second verse.
And the second one was the one that's
Paran.
But that makes no sense.
Take the money from the... The God appeared to them at Paran, at Harpach of Paran, and decided that, okay, given their responses, okay, we're going to take the money.
But that makes no sense, because we are using the Torah's verse as a second best instead of Habakkuk as a second best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Good point.
Seems backwards.
Well, it just doesn't seem relevant. You know,
it has
the
nothing
other one
to do with relevance.
But again, Ilana, you're right, and that bothers me. But the answer would be that in either case, this, whether it's a verse from Habakkuk, a verse from the Torah, even the verse from the Torah, we're not using in halachic exegesis. We're not
right.
Learning a word there and saying that word teaches this. It's just reminding us of a midrash. Okay. So now, time is running out. We have about an hour worth of work left, and we only have 10 minutes. So I'm going to tell you that at this point, we've actually finished.
Okay.
What the Gemara does now, it says, what were those other uses of the verse from Habakkuk that you just reminded us of? And it tells you what the other uses are. But it doesn't really come back, as far as I remember, to our question. It's some amazing stuff, by the way, that relates tangentially to our matters, but not directly. So therefore, why don't we skip a great deal of the Gemara, go to 161,
oh.
And we'll read the story of the Romans that I hinted to 40 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
So on page 161, Lamed Chet Amud Aleph, we're going to read line 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Okay.
Yeah. Tana Rabbanan. Tana Rabbanan, we learned in a bright. Does everyone have the place?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Don't work it. Go ahead.
Ukvar shalcha malchut Romi shnei sardeti. I can't pronounce it. Sardityotot. It's a Roman word that I don't know how to pronounce. Representatives. Etzel Chochmei Yisrael. We learned in a Braita, already sent the kingdom of Rome, two representatives to the Jewish sages. Lamdunu Toratchem. And the representative said, teach us your Torah. Karu v'shanu v'shilshu. They studied, and they said a second time, and they said a third time. The Hachamim taught these two non-Jews the whole Torah. And that means the whole Torah. All of Jewish literature.
Mm-hmm. In a minute and a half?
No, in 10 years. I don't know.
They competed with you.
With Rabbi Akiva. Bishat petiratan amrulehem. At the hour of their taking leave, they said to them, the two Roman representatives said to their rabbis, dikdaknu bechol toratchem vemetu. We've been very careful in studying your whole Torah, vemetu, and it's true. Chutz midavar zeshatem amrim, with the exception of this matter that you guys say, shur shel Yisrael shenagach shur shel goy pator shel goy shenagach shur shel Yisrael bein tam bein muad mishalem nezek shalem.
They didn't like that idea.
They didn't like it.
Everything.
Yeah. They liked everything but that. And they said, the Romans said, mimanafshach. Exactly what the Gemara had said. However you cut it, doesn't make any sense. Mimanafshach, ire eyudafka. That the Romans learned to do with their thumbs, right? Ire eyudafka. Afilu goy kinagach di Yisrael li patar. Vire eyu lavdafka afilu di Yisrael kinagach di goy di chayev. Just like the Gemara said earlier. If re eyu applies to goyim, then when the non-Jew gores the Jew, shouldn't have to pay. And if it doesn't apply, then when the Jew gores a non-Jew, he should have to pay. What is going on here?
What does dafka mean?
Applies, specifically. V'devar zeh ein anu modi'im oto lemalchut. But this matter, we're not going to tattle to the authorities.
Hmm. But it was found out anyway.
That is, they respected Torah so much, this one little thing didn't make sense. They're not going to make a big matter of it. So, there's something fascinating here. The passage in the Bavli has been put together from many different literary units. And I assume that it's done so on purpose, and each unit is woven in a certain place for a certain purpose. The question is, why did the Talmud end the whole matter of dealing with this Mishnah with the story about the Romans? What is it coming to teach us? To me, the answer is clear.
Well, it's a goofy mission.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's the point. In other words, after all the answers we gave...
After all of this, it still doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Hadrakush yaleduchta.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But isn't that something like... Isn't there some tradition where there are something like three things that cannot be totally explained in the Torah that are just... You just accept on faith, or there's something that...
You're right.
They're so crazy.
You're thinking of the paraduma, the red heifer. Mm-hmm. And chatnez.
Yeah. Something about the mixing of two linens or
something.
Woolen
linen, chatnez, right.
Chatnez.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but those are things being Adam l'makom between man and God.
That is not something
that's going to
make somebody mad.
That's very difficult for our PR.
This is something that's going to make somebody mad.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can understand.
This is going to lead to all kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Glad. Don't worry.
So I think it's fascinating to understand that the end, after all is said and done, the Talmud is almost explicitly telling us that it doesn't like its own answers.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. So what is the purpose of that?
Of telling us that?
Yeah.
Well, on the one end, I can say in general, that's the Talmudic methodology of leaving us with more questions than answers.
Oh,
and and being very honest to admit that it doesn't have
answers for everything.
Answers. In this specific matter... Mm-hmm. It's telling us you have to live with it. But we don't understand it.
But you skipped on such interesting
stuff. I did. Perhaps we'll do it after vacation.
Yes, please.
But I wanted to at least finish up the unit.
Yeah.
So with the few minutes that are left, why don't we, of all the wonderful sources I brought here, and it's hard to decide which to look at and which to skip.
Yeah, what is this Goy Ve'Osek B'Torah?
But the most fascinating thing that I brought in all these sheets is the Me'iri.
Okay.
Which is the end here, the second sheet.
Okay.
What I called here I.
Okay.
Hi. And we can end with the Me'iri. This is Beit HaBechira Rabbeinu Menachem Me'iri, Tractate Baba Kama, pages 37b and 38a. So just to remind everyone, the Me'iri lived in Provence in the 13th century, the 1200s. And Provence is the area that connects between France and Spain. The Jewish communities of Provence during this 100-year period, it was one of the most open periods in the sense of connection between Jews and non-Jews. You find great literary and scientific activity among the Jews. This is the place and time of the Ralbag, was the greatest Jewish scientist that ever lived. And perhaps one of the most controversial, it's hard to say most controversial, but a very controversial figure in Jewish history. On the one hand, his commentary on the whole Nach, Nevi'im Ketuvim, is printed in the traditional Mikraot Gedolot, and any student of Nach relies on the Ralbag as a basic foundation of Jewish exegesis. On the other hand...
How do you spell his initials?
Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon. On the other hand, the Ralbag's...
What's
Nevi'im.
Nevi'im Ketuvim.
The Ralbag's magnum opus of Jewish philosophy, Milchamot Hashem, Wars of the Lord, has been characterized by his detractors as wars against the Lord. And it hasn't been that... Learned it hasn't been that popular. He is a very, very... controversial figure. On the one hand, like I said, his works are accepted as explanations of Nach, but his philosophy has more or less been rejected. In that same period lived the Me'iri.
What kind of scientist?
He was an astronomer. He actually invented a navigational tool that was still in use until, I don't know, 300 years ago. It's called Jacob's staff or astrolabe.
That stuff emerged
from all their relationships with Spain, because all that scientific work was going on in Spain at that time.
Provence provided the Jews with an opportunity for contact both with Christians and with Muslims.
Provence was under Spanish rule at the time?
No, Provence was not under Spanish rule. Provence was where Rashi was?
I know.
Years earlier.
Yeah, but which?
I don't think that's true. Rashi was in northern Ashkenaz. He wasn't in Provence. I'm almost certain.
I thought he was in Provence.
Okay, we can.
But I'll look it up. I could easily be wrong.
So who is the person you've been talking
the
about?
Ralbag.
Who's the
Ralbag. Rabbi Levi ben Gershon. But this is the Meiri. I'm saying the Meiri is from a similar intellectual milieu. And the Meiri writes as follows. Oh, by the way, the Meiri's works were also lost to the Jewish world until about 1850, 1860, until they were rediscovered.
Whoa.
But that's a whole other issue. Shor shel Yisrael shenagach shor shel Nochri patur midin re'ehu. So he says explicitly that the ox of the Jew that gores the ox of the non-Jew is patur because of re'ehu. V'shel Nochri shenagach shel Yisrael and shel the non-Jew that gores the Jew bein tam bein mod mishalem nezek shalem mitoch she'ein chasim ha'mamon zu latam v'konsim otam shelo yergilu atzmam hazik lefi ma she'ne'amar b'gmara. Sorry. And he says that. So then, why did they have to pay when they gore us? Because we're konsim otam, we find them, in order not to accustom them to their ways of not watching their oxen, to make them watch. Just to make them be careful, to teach them to be careful. They're usually not so careful with the possessions of other people. They're barbarians. So we have to train them. That's all. And then he says something fantastic.
He quotes the Gemara.
The end of the second line, the last three words, is where I'm beginning. End of the second line, last three words. Ulefi ma she'ne'amar b'gemara, and according to what it says in the Gemara, davka, this discriminatory law is specifically be'amim she'enam gidurim b'darchei datot v'nimusim. Translation, this discriminatory law is specifically concerning those nations that are not restricted by the ways of religion and civility. Nimusim comes from the Greek nomos, law, and in medieval Jewish language it means civil law and civility. This phrase that I just read, Amim she'enam gidurim b'darchei datot v'nimusim, is one of the most famous. It's certainly a phrase that every scholar of medieval Jewish law and philosophy knows. It's a phrase that was innovated by the Meiri, and it has revolutionary significance throughout the Meiri's writings. And basically, to make a very long story short, the Meiri says that everything, just about everything the Talmud and Jewish law says about disparity between Jews and non-Jews, it only applies to the ancient nations that were not Gidurim, that didn't restrict themselves in the ways of religion and civility. But all those things don't apply today in the modern era of the 13th century, because the nations that we live among, us, by accepting Christianity, and he's basically talking about Christians, they've accepted the idea of moral law.
And doesn't Maimonides do something similar?
No, absolutely not.
He says that Christians and Muslims are not akum.
He does not say that. The Rambam says that Christians are complete idolaters.
Really?
Right.
And Muslims?
Complete not idolaters.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because he lives with the Muslims.
But the Meiri is not saying that Christians aren't idolaters. Their religion might be idolaters, but they have a religion. Mm-hmm. That's his point. They have a set of laws that they believe apply to restrict your behavior with other human beings. He says it doesn't matter if the religion would be defined as worshipping idols. It matters that they have a moral code. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Where the Muslims don't have a moral code.
I know, I didn't say that.
I know he didn't say that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then he says, I'm going to prove it to you from the Gemara. We're in the middle of the third line. Kamo shamar aleihem b'gemara. Like it says concerning them in the Gemara. And look at his daring exegesis here. He quotes last three words of the third line. Ra'ah sheva mitzvot shekiblu aleihem b'nei noach shelo kimum amad vitir mamonam. Translation. God saw the seven mitzvot that they accepted upon themselves, the Bnei Noach, and didn't uphold them. God stood and released their money. That's the quote from the Gemara. He says, Kol sha'a shadin mechayvam bechach. God released their money all the while that the law would require that. Ha, behold, kol sheshev mitzvot biadam, behold, all the while the sheshev mitzvot are in their hand, if they're keeping the sheshev mitzvot, dinam etzlenu kedinenu.
Wow.
Their law by us is like our law. And I think the next word, etzlam, is a mistake. He says, look, what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says that the goyim are being punished for not keeping the Sheva Mitzvot.
Their own laws.
Yeah.
No, wait a second. The Miri says, therefore, their punishment applies only in generations when they're not keeping the Sheva Mitzvot. He said, look at the goyim in my time, they're keeping them. Right. Therefore, the law of the Mishnah is cancelled.
That's heavy.
So we can say that too.
According to the Miri, you can say that too.
So they became Re'ehu?
Whoa!
Yeah,
3 points! Very good! The Miri says that exact thing. The Miri says, you just said something very, very important.
I know.
The Miri says in other sources that that means that every nation who, in general, are Gidurim, Bidarchei Hadat v'nimusim, every nation that restricts its members according to the ways of religion and law, they become Re'ehu. And the Miri says that not just for this law, but for tens of other laws. And that's a very, very powerful statement. And it's greatly, greatly discussed in modern halachic discussions. Because it changes so much about Jewish law. And it's very, very controversial.
So that time of the Meiri, was at the time of the debates, the public debates?
The Meiri himself was not involved in polemics. He tells...
No. I'm just asking if that was the period.
It was the time, but not the place.
So but maybe that's how he gave ammunition to Jews to protect themselves in polemics.
No. I don't know that much, but as far as I remember, he wasn't involved in that
milieu
at all.
Okay.
So let's just finish last line. Yeah, that's it. That's it. We're finished.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yay.
So